Part of surfing the quicksand is trying to bring as much information as I can to people just like me, midlife women struggling with all sorts of things in the world and in our bodies, and trying to help us get unstuck from where we might be and think about moving forward. One of those things always on my mind is, again, kind of that health and body situation. And today I'm talking with somebody who's an expert in that space, and we're talking about skin. We're going to be talking with someone in the dermatology space because what we see and what we feel is so much a part of this very big organ on our bodies, our skin. Let's talk about our health, the things we should be thinking about, the things we should be watching for, and the actions we could be taking every single day to help preserve what we still have. As a reminder, surfing the quicksand is entertainment, and none of the information you see today or hear today should be considered medical advice. Welcome to Surfing the Quicksand. I'm your host, Kathy Vines. As part of surfing the quicksand, I want to talk about things that midlife women care about and make sure I'm having just honest girlfriend to girlfriend conversations about things that might be on a lot of our minds and sometimes afraid to ask questions about, or we hear different things and we don't really know how to navigate them. And this is especially relevant when we're talking about our bodies. And so, as I continue to bring on some experts onto Surfing the Quicksand, I want to make sure that I'm getting some of my own questions answered. And today is a great example of that. So, I have a dermatology expert with us today because I think of skin and hair and nails, but really skin as one of, I think, the only organs in our bodies that is also very outward facing and part of how we show up in the world. So it's on our minds maybe a little bit differently than other organs that are being impacted by hormone changes and menopause and just aging and being in our 40s and 50s and our bodies kind of really feeling like it's been on this planet for half a century. So today I'm introducing you to a physician associate, Amy Ackland, who has been in the medical dermatology space for over 18 years in the Boston area. And not surprisingly, she works with people around kind of skin cancer and important skin diseases, some other skin conditions and medical conditions that we would have, again, for any age from acne all the way up, as well as some of the more aesthetic and cosmetic side of dermatology and our skin. And we're going to talk about all these things today. Welcome, Amy.
Thanks so much, Kathy. It's awesome to be here with you.
I want to start first. I introduced you as a physician associate, and that's like a PA that we often hear. So sometimes people don't really know what a PA is, and I thought maybe we would start right there. Can you tell us what a physician associate is?
Yeah, absolutely. So a physician associate or PA or another term that people use is physician assistant, is a profession, a group of people who have attended a graduate program and are able to see patients independently and prescribe medication. So that's kind of the short answer. Similar to a nurse practitioner, but our schooling is a little bit different.
Okay. And so when I call and I'm like, oh, I want to come in and see doctor, and they're like, well, we can't see the doctor, but you can see a PA. She's available on Thursday. I've never batted an eye. Is there a reason I might say, oh, no, I probably should wait to see the doctor?
I don't think so at all, because PAs, as physician associates, we need to know our limitations. And so if there is anything that is really outside of the norm, what we're really good at is knowing what we know. And working in concert, we always work with a physician so that if there is something that's outside of our sphere of knowledge, that that's something that gets passed on and worked up collaboratively.
Great. Thank you. I mean, this is something that has nothing to do with midlife and nothing to do with anything. We're always navigating a complicated medical system. And so sometimes just debunking some of the terminology is part of all of this. I know that you've been in dermatology specifically for, gosh, almost 2 decades. And so I would love to kind of start with you explaining a little bit about why dermatology, what you enjoy about working with patients in this space.
Well, through training, I really enjoyed just working in the clinic environment. So, you have all sorts of opportunities throughout school where you have sort of access to different settings, right? So, I was in hospitals, I was in a surgery clinic, various settings, outpatient settings too. And so you sort of figure out where you gravitate to. I enjoy doing procedures. I enjoy checking in with people over a period of time. So one of the things that I love about my job is that I see children grow up. I see, people navigating life stuff, and they check in with me, sometimes frequently, sometimes just once a year, and sometimes less than that. But I, at this stage of the game, I go to work and I see old friends sometimes. So I really like that part.
That's great. I also think of dermatology to kind of start to shift into the medical side of what you do. It's not like, oh, we go to the dentist twice a year because our dentist does stuff, right? I don't think of, unless you've had something show up in your life, I don't think of a dermatologist as something that you just kind of go in for regular routine until something shows up, right? So I know for me, I honestly don't know when people are supposed to be going to a dermatologist. We'll start with that. So I will say, I think I first went to a dermatologist screening maybe 8 years ago. It might be 9 years ago. It was my first time. And I was in my, I was probably 46, 47. And oh my gosh, I'm remembering it now. It was a Valentine's Day special. It was free screenings for couples, like a Valentine's Day date night. And I convinced my husband that we should go. I don't know why or when we would have gone. Like, first of all, great marketing, but like, I don't know why else or when we would have gone, except for the fact that it's like always one of those. Oh, I know I should. Yeah, my doctor's always asking me, have you gone to a dermatologist screening yet? Do you need a referral? Have you gotten that yet? So let's start with that. Like, when do and should people start thinking of at least going to get a screening at a dermatologist?
That's a good question. I think that a lot of times what is reported to me is that a patient's primary care provider will have recommended that they go. Skin is different, and I find what I mean by that is that in various medical training, skin is kind of its own thing a little bit. And so you either kind of have an affinity for it or not. And so I think that a lot of primary care providers turf that out, and rightly so. I think that a lot of times, unless you look at it all day, every day, it is really hard sometimes to make that judgment call and, whether something is benign or not, or whether something needs care or not. And so I very much appreciate providers who will not automatically refer, but appropriately so. Know their own limitations to what they're comfortable with and refer someone for routine screening more readily than not. One of the things that I hate when it happens to a patient of mine is when that they've been told that something's okay or they can ignore something, or maybe they have, and then finally they come to find out this actually would have been treatable a while ago. Now this is actually more involved. So I much prefer being more involved on the earlier side of things. And I encourage all my patients, anytime they notice something new or they're uncomfortable with something, I want to hear from them.
I think if is there we hear ages specifically around things like colonoscopies and other kinds of things. Is there an age that if you were to hear from a woman that she's never had a dermatology screening, that you'd be like, That has me concerned that you've never had a baseline.
I don't think there's a magic age, so I don't exactly have a number for you, but I think that if at any time, and this is inclusive of children, that if there's something that's noted that's out of the norm, or certainly if someone has a lot of moles, they should have some kind of baseline check and be established with someone on the earlier side in their 20s and 30s. Not necessarily just in midlife and beyond.
And moles is a the thing that we hear about most, right? Is like, oh, know what you have, know what they look like, pay attention if that changes, right? So I think that becomes a really good, just a outward physical trigger and marker for us if that's something that we have or things like that. The idea of being able to go in, and what I've also had in my own personal experience is going in and people saying like, oh, honestly, that thing that you're bothered about, like, that's actually fine. This other thing, let's look at it though. Or honestly, if it's bothering you, we can take care of it, right? We can just for cosmetic purposes, like, I don't have any concerns about it medically, but if for a cosmetic purpose you want to look at it, we can find. So having that experience too, I think is great. And I think that's a little bit part of the having a relationship with your dermatologist, right? And feeling like they know me, I trust them, they're not going to push something that I'm not comfortable with, or they're going to open up question like, you know, if you want to look at this, we can do that.
Yeah, absolutely. Like your concerns are my concerns. And so even if that's, I consider it a great thing. Sometimes people feel like they're bothering me or they're apologetic for the fact that like, oh, I'm sorry to bother you with this, or I'm sorry that it wasn't something. And I actually think it's great to be able to tell someone, I'm so glad to be able to tell you don't have to worry about this. So that happens with some kind of frequency because sometimes the really odd things are okay, but I'd much prefer to be the person to tell you that and also just to take down the level of concern about it than one to have someone worry on their own. I never like that. And two, they can take that concern level down and just relax. But also we can do the skin check, we can look at other things and just make sure there's not anything else that they've been overlooking. As you said, sometimes the concerning things aren't that concerning to the person who is experiencing them, and or they're in a difficult spot to see that they're just not surveilling very easily.
Right. We can, there's only so much of our body that we can see independently. So I just kind of talked about moles. Let's open up, like, what are the things that you're looking for or that people are coming to you for to say, I have a concern, or my doctor pointed out a concern. What are the, let's start with, we can go from like very serious down to not so serious.
Well, I mean, in a broad kind of way, I would say anything that's new or changing. And certainly something that would be hurting, bleeding, or persistently itching. I think those things are kind of broad categories that I would have someone come in for an evaluation of something that's new. Certainly, I encourage my patients to consider that taking care of their skin is a partnership because it does require repeated visits often, because the skin isn't static. Things change, and you might develop something in a year that you didn't have before, and it's important to make sure to sort of log that and take account of that. But are you talking more about like specific signs as far as melanomas?
No, well, I mean, we can certainly talk about melanomas. Let's start with like, what is that serious stuff that you might be working with people? And gosh, cancer is, I'm guessing, the worst thing that comes up when we're talking about skin, but honestly, I don't even know that that's true.
Oftentimes it is. And so I think where we'd really be focusing on sort of the most common dangerous cancers, that would be melanoma. And melanoma is it can range from just need to remove it to be life-threatening. So, it is important to be on the lookout for at all times. And it can be any color. It can be any shape, and frankly, they can be quite subtle sometimes. So, the typical things to look for are the ABCDEs. So this is probably something you could just Google and see sort of a pictorial kind of thing quite easily. But A is for asymmetry, B border, meaning scalloped or kind of irregular edges. C refers to color, different colors within the same spot. D will classically stand for diameter, meaning larger than the head of a pencil eraser. I also like D for dark. Now, not all melanomas are going to be dark, but if you were to develop something that were jet black, just off the charts dark, that would be something worth looking at. And then E is evolving. So that's anything kind of growing or changing. So you can kind of appreciate from that it's a wide range of things. And sometimes it's hard to kind of know, but I think it's useful to know, whether it's for yourself or someone else, what those things are, because it's not, sometimes it is pretty straightforward. And so, I've even heard a story of a child who was looking at their parents' medical journal, and they had looked at the warning signs of melanoma, and they pointed out a melanoma on their parents' the back of their parents' leg. And it was, in fact, a melanoma.
Wow,
So,
yeah.
yeah.
And we do a lot of conversations here on Surfing the Quicksand about being an adult child of aging parents. And not that I want to spend a lot of our time in this episode, because I am really concerned about me and my skin. But like, we are often the one who are seeing our parents and maybe seeing more of their body. Talk about we don't see as much of our body. I think our aging parents probably see even less of it often. And if they are not also seeing a doctor regularly, or they don't have a dermatologist in mind, the idea that you might see something in a parent and say, wait a minute, this actually checks some boxes for me. Now I have to convince my parent, oh, no, it's not nothing. No, you actually haven't always had that. Yes, I get it that you in the 60s went to the beach every day in your itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini, but like, now's the time we got to go get that checked out.
Yeah, and particularly for that age, the stories that people tell me of older people are, the classic sort of iodine and baby oil. That is the regular, this is how we went to the beach, and we went every day. And so that person's sun exposure is a lot, and it's significant, and it's probably, I hope it's different from what is currently the norm. I think many people are more aware of sunscreen. There are more options available. Of course, skin cancer is still rampant, but for that older population, they got a lot of sun exposure before they were an adult, and now it's kind of coming to bear. So, like, as we get older, the skin starts to show us damage that we did in our earlier days. And then, certainly older people are more prone to really common types of skin cancer. They're super common, but oftentimes not dangerous, not of the same level of melanoma. But basal cell being the most common skin cancer, actually the most common cancer there is, and squamous cell carcinoma. So oftentimes those things are going to present as something that just doesn't heal. So I think that's a really useful point. As a child of an older person, to be aware, like, oh, you've had that little red spot on your face now, and it's growing, or it often bleeds. Those are things that I think should be pointed out if not being picked up on by like their regular physician.
That's really helpful, because I also think about they're going to their regular physician about a whole host of things, right? And even if they wrote everything down on a list, you know, that the leave, gee, I have this little spot here that seems to be lingering, like it might be 10th on the list and not even gotten to compared to the other things that they're talking to their doctor about. So for us to be bringing more attention to that or saying like maybe it's a different doctor we need to talk to about this is part of that process. You mentioned basal cell and squamous. I tend to think of basal cell, I only know about it as like on your face. Is that where that's happening, or is that just I see people with band-aids on their face and they're giving me an explanation and that's why.
I think it's absolutely frequently on the face, but no, basal cells actually can be anywhere in the body. In fact, 20% of basal cells are where we don't get sun. So, yeah, that's a sort of, I think, salient factoid is that we can get skin cancer anywhere because it happens where you have skin. So, not necessarily just due to sun.
Interesting. All right. Okay, let's pivot a little bit and talk because you mentioned kind of sunscreen and habits today. So I want to talk a little bit about prevention or what we can be doing responsibly around skin cancer today. What are some things that you think people should be doing always, sometimes never when it comes to skincare?
Truthfully, I'm a fan of sunscreen. Broad spectrum daily sunscreen. It's a little bit of a boring message, but really anywhere that's exposed. So I use it every day, year round, to anything that's exposed. My face, my neck, the backs of my hands are a sort of no-brainer. And then, as seasons change, I'll apply it other places as well. And I recommend that my patients do the same.
When we're thinking about SPFs for a just a daily, this is I'm just going shopping. I'm just doing something. So I'm not beach day, but just like out in the world. How do we think about the right number for us?
The general recommendation is at least an SPF of 30. So if someone prefers a 50 or beyond, that's totally fine. If someone has sensitive skin, I might not go with those higher SPFs and, stick with the SPF 30. Sometimes I see a sensitivity there, but generally an SPF 30. And then the other thing I like to mention to people is that it's really important to reapply it after a couple of hours. So something that sometimes people don't really realize is that it's a photochemical reaction is what actually protects you. And what sort of uses up the sunscreen is the sun. So the stronger the sun, the quicker your sunscreen gets used up. So usually what I tell people is if we're in, the Boston area, every couple of hours is okay, but if they go to Aruba or some kind of, high sun environment, you really need to be applying your sunscreen every hour.
So even if we're not swimming or sweating, just the fact that we are putting our SPF to work, doing the thing it's supposed to do, it's getting used up more quickly if it's getting more sun exposure.
That's right.
That's really helpful because I don't necessarily I'm one of those people where I can feel like, oh, I feel like I'm getting red. Like I feel like I must be the burn, right? I feel like oh, I need to reapply. Like I let my body tell me it's time to reapply. I don't think I have a clock in my mind. I'm like, well, I've been out and about for a few hours, even in Boston, even just like walking around. So time to put more on. That's really helpful to kind of think about.
And especially when you're doing, certain activities like a lot of patients who golf, put it in your golf bag or it is a hard habit. It's something that is a difficult one to introduce. But for people who work outdoors or have a lot of outdoor hobbies, I'll at least work with them to try to reapply at lunch. At least we're getting one reapplication. Yes, the general recommendation is every 2 hours, but if that's just not feasible or realistic, then I think, I'm also a pragmatist. Let's just get it on there at lunch also.
I think pragmatism is that helpful line, right? Between this is what I should do, or this is what the doctors recommend, or this is what I hear in cautionary tales versus, that just doesn't fit my lifestyle, or that doesn't fit my budget, or all sorts of, right? A good sunscreen is not $2, right? So to be able to say, like, oh, well, what is my budget on this? Sometimes that even that's getting in people's way.
Budget, or I certainly just don't want it to be a write-off. Well, I'm never going to be able to do it like that, so I'm just not going to use it. Some is better than none, and more frequent is better than less.
Yeah. That's great. Like that concept of the write-off, right, is just like, well, if I can't do what they're telling me, I might as well not bother and do anything, and trying to combat that is helpful. Now, okay.
Not one of us is. And sunscreen is made in a lab and designed to apply a certain amount per surface area. And clearly, well, most people don't measure it, per surface area, right? So we need to use enough of it to generate that SPF rating too. And so just because of the nature of it, we're going to miss the mark sometimes. So it's just doing the best we can.
It's helpful. And I think you're right. Right. It'll be like, oh, put a dime size dot. Like, thank God we are kind of know what a dime is, I assume. But like, oh yeah, that's great. But my body is different than your body. And a dime doesn't go as far in one person's body than another. I know that you and I have had conversations about, expiration dates on sunscreen. So what can you remind people about expiration dates on sunscreen?
Well, first of all, if you're using it with the frequency that I'm talking about, you probably won't have it around, because you'd go through it in a weekend or, not you wouldn't be holding on to it past that expiration date, generally speaking. But it's useful to just chuck it at that point because you want it to work well. And so I think where there's this question of, is it still gonna do what I need it to do? It's just not worth the gamble. So my general rule of thumb would be just to pitch it and move on.
I
And
think, okay.
not to overbuy. So
The overbuy is what you're reminding, right? So when you said, oh, if you're using it, chances are, like, yeah, except if you went to Costco and you got the 3-pack thinking this is going to last me all summer, and then you didn't use it that way, and then it's next year, and then it's the year after that, and you still have that Costco package. And so I really do think you're absolutely right. It's that overbuying that can get you a little bit in trouble if you don't really know. How are you going to use it before then? And then you're like, well, I already spent good money on it, so I might as well just use it. But if it's not doing the thing you need it to do.
right. Maybe it's in that category with the Costco stuff as like the giant bag of lettuce.
You're
Always goes
unlikely to get
bad.
through that.
You're
You're
unlikely
unlikely.
to get through it in that time that it's going to go bad. Then don't get that one. Get it in smaller quantities and get more when you need it.
And I know that, when you get a tube of sunscreen, the date is often printed in the little crimpy part on the edge. And so taking out my phone and using the magnifier to be able to see exactly what that date is has been really helpful. And it's like anything else as an organizer, I'm always saying, gee, when you open up a package and the expiration date is on the box that you're about to throw out, could you write it in a Sharpie on the container that you just had, right? Give future you a gift on how to maintain these things that are important.
Yeah, I think generally they are printed on the actual container too, but yeah, that's definitely a good idea.
I want to talk a little bit about other skincare and what besides a sunscreen, like what are some like just good practice skincare that midlife women should be focusing on, knowing what's going on with our skin? Like, so what is going on with our skin at this age?
Well, we're definitely losing collagen and elastin, right? So these are proteins that are found in our skin. And collagen, you can think of as kind of like scaffolding, right? It's like the steel girders of buildings. It holds everything in place. Elastin is what is a really sort of has a lot of stretch to it, just like the name, right? Elastic. Elastin, and that means that you can kind of like it's fluid, and that it snaps back after you let go. So as those things just naturally kind of go away, we can do certain things to kind of preserve them as much as possible. We're not going to look like we're 20 anymore, and I don't necessarily think that's the goal for most people, but there are things that we can do from a skincare perspective, and they're sort of tried and true. So I would say a gentle skin cleanser rather. So this is usually something that doesn't foam. And I'm saying this as someone who lives and works in the Northeast, where the skin, it's very dry. We heat our homes, and a lot of times where we live is very dry. And so I think most people have dry skin, in the winter, especially. Unless you truly have oily skin, I would use a cleanser that doesn't foam. And then I think getting some kind of, if it depends on someone's overall goals, right? So if they don't really mind wrinkles or, those kinds of age-related changes, you don't have to do anything other than I recommend sunscreen and a gentle cleanser moisturizer. That's it. But if you are looking to kind of go a step further and preserve the, and actually rebuild collagen, then that's getting some kind of retinoid on board. So those are retinols over the counter or tretinoin, which is a prescription.
Okay, I want to go back to the foaming cleanser first. Is the fact that it foams dangerous, or what is it about foaming cleanser that has you saying that's not for us?
Well, it's just mostly, it's not dangerous, no. But what it will do potentially, and this isn't true of every single foaming cleanser, but many, so that's why I'm kind of speaking in general terms, that it will remove more of the oils and strip the skin more, which is useful if you have really oily skin, but if you don't, then you might be overdoing it. And especially if then you're going to use potentially some other active ingredients like retinols, which can be drying to the skin, then you don't want to sort of be adding in that direction. We want to keep the hydration in the skin. And not to mention just with age, that's also sort of a age-related, decrease in the hydration of the skin too. The skin becomes thinner and drier over time.
Okay, so going back to the retinoids, did I say that right? Retinoids, yes. There's the over the counter, which is this is a cream. It's an additive to something I'm putting on my face as opposed to something I'm eating or ingesting.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes, the topical cream that you put on and leave on at nighttime.
Okay. So I'm doing it at night. I feel like I don't know what happened. This might not have been a retinol, might have been like a some sort of acid, right? Hyaluronic acid. Again, I have no idea what a lot of these things are. But I remember there was a moment, gosh, this must be almost 20 years ago, where I used some product and also sunscreen or something and went out and went golfing for the day and came home and my face just looked like a strawberry. Like it was crazy. And I was with some girlfriends today. I took a picture and sent to them. I'm like, did I look like this all day? And realized it had something to do with either doing two things at the same time I shouldn't, or one without the other. What's in that space that we want to pay attention to?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what happened to you. You may have had some kind of photochemical reaction, meaning that you put whatever you put on was more sensitive in the sun, and then it got a lot worse when you went in the sun. But the reason primarily why you want to use retinols at nighttime would be that it breaks down in the sunshine. So in order for it to do its work, you need to put it on at nighttime.
Okay. And so that's going to help with this is about the collagen or the elastin or both.
Actually, it's really hard to regain lost elastin, but it does help with collagen, with building collagen. So there are a few things that do, but retinols and tretinoin, those are the best ways that are easy to obtain to rebuild collagen. But I would think about it as more like going to the gym to build muscles. It's not something that happens overnight or even in a week. This is more like at least 3 to 6 months to really see any kind of change in your skin.
Okay. Are there other things that we can be doing for collagen? Like, is there food that we eat or other considerations like hydrating, all the other things that are supposed to be helping with our skin?
That's an interesting area that's kind of evolving. So there are collagen supplements out there. And I've had a couple patients come to me saying they feel like it's helped them a whole lot. There are a couple of examples where they're getting some studies behind them, but by and large, it's not something that I recommend or think is really absorbable are going to make a difference visually. So
So,
generally not. Like there's not like a food that you can eat or something like that.
okay. Sticking with kind of these topical creams, knowing using them the right way, using them at night, knowing that it's going to take a few months before you're going to see a real change if you see one. It's just a little bit of patience and
Yeah.
is all part of that.
This is slow and steady wins the race because, as I said before, they're drying. So if you overuse them because you want the problem to be gone 2 weeks ago, you're just going to be dry and miserable and have sort of a retin-A kind of dermatitis. We call it retinoid dermatitis.
Okay. Women our age, menopause, other things like that, also getting things like acne or other impacts hormonally. What else do you see that are is really specific about kind of that perimenopause, those triggers?
It's often a rosacea kind of scenario. So I would think of this as sort of an adult form of acne. It's a problem of inflammation in the skin. And so that can be sort of an adult concern where someone never had a problem before. Or seborrheic dermatitis is another one. This can occur to the face. So another name for that is good old-fashioned dandruff. But we can get dandruff anywhere. We have oily, oil sort of hair-bearing kinds of areas too. So you can get this to the scalp, but oftentimes people have it around the nose or lip or even on the, chin and jaw.
That's so interesting. I'd never heard of that. Let's talk about hair for a second. You mentioned dandruff in the hair, and so I know that hair thinning and hair loss in midlife and perimenopause and lots of things in life is showing up more and more of a concern for probably people listening to this podcast than maybe it was 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah, I
Is
think hair
it?
having a moment.
Yeah, hair loss is having a moment. Is hair loss something we're going to a dermatologist for?
Yes, absolutely. And so it's another thing that I would encourage anyone who has concerns about it to go sooner rather than later, because again, never want anyone to worry alone. And then also, there are things that we can do sometimes. So not all hair loss is irreversible. I think that's something that's useful to know too. Sometimes it is irreversible, occasionally, but generally speaking, there are sort of reasons that we can explore and sometimes things to try too.
So somebody comes to you, woman, in 50s comes in saying, I've been having some hair loss, and maybe it's been driven by weight loss. Maybe it's been driven by I've been on this medication and the medication's working for me, but I have hair loss. What are some other kind of reasons that might be coming up for somebody that might be driving a hair loss for them?
Well, it sounds maybe like you're talking about kind of a shedding kind of process or that kind of, is that what you mean with the
Yes, but
hair?
what else should I be thinking about?
Well, so I guess the first thing I do is really just listen to the person's story. What are they telling me about their hair loss? Is this a problem that started 10 years ago and it's happened really slowly? Or is this something that they can kind of pinpoint the day? They'll tell me, gosh, this started happening in September and it's gone on since then, over the past 3 months. Okay. And then also, what kind of volume are we talking about? Do they notice the hair? Do they see it around? Is it like on their pillow or when they comb their hair or shampoo their hair? Or is it not really something that they notice, but they're just noticing that their hair is a little less full? So these are really like distinct parts of the story that I listen for, because it gives me clues, and then that's confirmed by what I see when I actually examine the scalp. So most commonly, and I'm talking about in broad terms of two kinds of hair loss, one being that sort of shedding piece, which is called telogen effluvium, if you've ever heard of that. But then the other would be more of like a genetically predisposed kind of hair loss, more akin to like male pattern baldness. And these are really common, but they have sort of very distinct stories and then distinct treatments. So it's important to kind of get to the root as to why it's happening.
And I know that's it's different than I can imagine, like with alopecia or some other diseases that I've seen that can impact kind of the scalp and things like that. Like, so I'm thinking about something different than that, I think.
Yeah, so I think
Yeah.
that what you're referring to when you say alopecia is maybe alopecia areata. And what that is, it's like a patchy kind of hair loss. So you might have like
Yeah.
a all of a sudden, and usually interestingly, people don't notice the hair in this instance. It's just there all of a sudden. And it's a patchy hair loss. And it's quite bald in that spot. But, so again, it goes back to distribution, but that alopecia in general is kind of a garden variety term for hair loss in general. So, so alopecia areata, different from just like sort of more of the general term.
Good, thank you. I'm learning so much. Okay, so somebody comes in and they say, I've been noticing shedding, I've been noticing thinning, I don't like how it looks. I can tell when I look that, it's and so now it's about the cosmetic, right? You're saying like, okay, there's probably not a medical thing we're concerned about disease-wise, but I appreciate and understand that this is a cosmetic experience, an aesthetic experience you don't want to have. What are the things that people can be doing to prevent, prepare, treat that if it's kind of this broader, like, oh, I've been shedding. I don't know how long it's been going on. I just don't
Right.
like how it looks.
So that piece is more of the telogen effluvium, and I would actually put it maybe a bit more in the medical category than I mean, certainly people have aesthetic concerns about it. And that for women, our hair is like our identity, right? So that can be really, really difficult. It can be a really emotional, tearful kind of visit, because it feels like they're never going to get it back. But actually, I have really hopeful news, because if you can identify the medicine, either the medicine that triggered it, or maybe it's a thyroid abnormality, or maybe it's iron deficiency, or now sometimes an extreme stressor can cause that kind of reaction, or a hormonal shift. So it's always worth kind of like looking at all those things to see maybe what triggered it. Sometimes it's nothing, which is kind of frustrating. But if you can kind of correct for those things, they're more likely to get better faster. But I tell people who have that it's kind of like a shift. It's this process has started where, if you think of your hair as kind of like factory workers, each little hair unit as like a factory worker, there's been a stress of some kind on the factory, and many of them went on break at the same time. It doesn't mean that they're not there. They're coming back, but it's going to take a while. And many of them just all exited the building at the same time, so it feels like less stuff is happening. And so it's a hard one to kind of like conceptualize. So sometimes I, go to some kind of metaphor like that, because feels so distressing. But to let people know that this is often a self-limited problem and it goes away on its own, generally in 3 to 6 months. But it can take even up to a year for that just to sort of go away on its own. Rarely it can go on beyond a year. Those people also don't go bald, but their hair is always less full than it was. And there's not tons to do about it at that stage, but that's not the norm. So I don't have reason to, when I see a particular person, to think that they're gonna have that chronic kind of form of it. It usually goes away on its own. So I have a hopeful message. It is a little frustrating because sometimes what people leave with is, oh, I know what it's called, but there's nothing really to do. And I think a lot of people like something to do.
For sure. And there are a million, as with everything we've talked about today, there are a million products out there of companies trying to sell us a solution that's fast acting and no side effects and instant results,
That's so true.
and none of
So
that is
true.
true. Yeah.
Especially in the hair loss industry. I really think that, apart from a couple of like tried and true things for certain diagnoses, it's the Wild West. So.
Yeah. Well, I think so. I think another really important part of this conversation is when we kind of said, when should you go to a dermatologist? And we were talking about moles and other kind of things you see in skin. Like maybe it's your hair, which is taking you to the dermatologist. And people might not have thought about that. The last thing external is like our nails. Anything that we should, I think that's also potentially go see the dermatologist, right? If we are having issues with our nails.
Nails, absolutely. Sometimes it is sort of a growth concern, or maybe it's a fungus or something of that nature, where you're noticing sort of a change in the nail, and it's treatable. But also there are skin cancers of the nail, and so that's not something that I think we often think about, but I think it's important to think about. And many times, my patients will come to me with painted fingernails. And they go and have their nails done with whatever frequency they do. But the only person who actually examines their nails, and it's not really their job, is the manicurist. They're not there to screen for skin cancers or potential cancers of the nail. So that can be important too when you come in for a regular screening just to remove the polish. What
I don't wear a lot of polish, but it never would have occurred to me like, oh, my annual dermatology screening is 2 weeks from now. I should go in with unadorned kind of bare nails just so that I can get a full review.
It's true. We want to see you without makeup and unadorned nails.
Last thing I want to talk about before we switch over to the Quicksand 3 is we've kind of talked on a little bit of kind of a SPF always, especially a daily SPF, retinol at night. Anything else that you think? Oh, and a good cleanser that isn't necessarily foaming because we don't want to strip away the oils that our body actually needs unless you have really oily skin. Any other kind of product categories that when we're thinking kind of head to toe, hair, skin, nails that you kind of hope people are taking into consideration?
Yeah, I think there's one other thing that we didn't talk about, which is the potential for vitamin C antioxidants. I don't know if that's something you've heard about at all, but this is something that can kind of be just generally supportive for, again, that like sort of preservation of the collagen and elastin that we have, that we just are reticent to give up and want to preserve it as long as we can. So vitamin C antioxidants used in the morning will help with things like sun exposure and environmental pollutants that would otherwise kind of trigger the degradation of those proteins that we're interested in keeping. So that could be something to that I think is useful. That I think there's some evidence behind that could be if for someone who wants a really well-rounded routine and is interested in being as proactive as they can.
And is that a cream or is that a something I'm taking, like a vitamin? What does that look like?
It's something that's topical. So these come in various serums. They come in a lot of different price points too. So you do want to look for something that's, generally more stable. And that's something that you'd want to discard for sure when the expiration is past, because it isn't as stable. But some of the slightly pricier ones, it can definitely run the gamut. But there are some at even the pharmacy that are quite nice.
And is this, so I can buy them over the counter, but they could be pricey. And weird question, am I putting, if I'm doing my daily SPF moisturizer and I'm doing that, am I doing one before the other?
Yes, generally, so the order would go cleanser and then any serums. So you want to kind of like layer the thinnest thing to the thickest thing, and the SPF being last.
Okay, that's
And I think the simpler the routine, the better. I think there are so many, we're bombarded with so many different things, and I think the best thing we can do for our skin is just to really get down to the basics. This isn't a lot of times it's about consistency and just like sticking with like good old tried and trues. It's not that exciting, but it is what's gonna give you probably your best result.
Well, I like that you've talked about it very intentionally in a way of saying there are things that we can do to help preserve what we still have left, right? Some of the collagen, some of the elastin is definitely like left the building for good. Sounds like not much we can do about the elastin, but the collagen is something that we can continue to support. And I know there's a whole other conversation around kind of fillers and Botox, like the things we can do to kind of replicate what our body used to look like, or maybe not even. And that's a whole different conversation. This is really around kind of healthy skincare and understanding our relationship with our dermatologist and when we should go and talk to them about things we're concerned about or want to just kind of hold on to as long as we can. So I'm so appreciative for you to kind of have this time with me, answer my dumb questions. I'm going to put a lot of this information, that things that we talked about in the show notes, which means I'm definitely going to come back to you and say, how did you spell Tila something, something, something? And yeah, maybe even some things will become new household names for people besides just me. Let's
Happy.
talk. Go ahead.
I'm happy to do that, and so glad to be here.
Good. Thank you. So let's talk about this with Quicksand 3, which is what I ask all my guests, and it's really anchored in what I hope the podcast does for people and helping women get unstuck and think about how to live a little bit differently and with the time we have left here. First is, what is a way that when you're procrastinating, what's a tip or technique that you have to get unstuck and do the thing you've been avoiding?
I think it goes to just breaking it down into smaller blocks and giving myself just whatever feels palatable. It might even be 15 minutes, 20 minutes, and just setting a timer and just seeing what I can do in that time. But not letting it get too big and weighty and just nipping away at it. And then it will, reveal what kinds of efforts I'll need to take after that.
Just making it sometimes just making it smaller. And I do the set a timer and what can I do, or I just did this the other day. I'm like, oh, I have 9 minutes before the washer ends and I have to put it in the dryer. What can I do in those 9 minutes? Like I just kind of gamified it for myself and I was shocked at how much I got done.
Yes, gamify is it. It's
Yeah.
it makes that much more fun and kind of tricks our brain, I think.
Next question. If schooling and education and time and history and money and all sorts of things were no issue, what is a career or job you might have liked to have tried?
Do you know what I'm going to say? No.
No?
A flower farmer.
Oh, of course. So I know that you are very into flowers. So tell people what very into flowers means.
Yeah, I grow a lot of dahlias, so that's really my love. And for anyone who knows the Dahlia world, it's just very addictive. And gosh, there's so many varieties and they're so beautiful and they're so gratifying to grow and give away. So my collection is growing and it's sort of like a fantasy, but I also am really doing it too on some level. So it's just fun. I like the problem solving. I like the hard work. And I think farmers just have to be some of the smartest people. They just have to be ready to react to anything and at the whim of nature too. So just fun.
That's such a complex answer of not just around the, gee, I love the flowers, but like what it would mean. What is the skill set or the competencies of being someone who would be good at farming those flowers? And okay, you said your collection is large. Like, give an indication of how large the collection is so people kind of understand that.
I have about 1,100 plants. So right now they're in tuber form, but eventually they'll all be growing plants and flowering and producing lots of blooms. So, yeah.
That's
Okay.
amazing. I think
1,100.
there are lots of people who love dahlias and or like it is their life's mission to be good at dahlias. Like that's a really unique thing. And again, we live in New England where it's a very different kind of animal than growing it in other parts of the country. So there's even that other complexity too.
Maybe I should amend my answer. I've moved to the Pacific Northwest and flower farmer. Better
That
weather.
right, and again, both of those are still potentially in the future for you.
There
And then finally, what's a way that you kind of recharge or hit the reset button when life gets chaotic?
for me, this is usually something grounding in my body. So it depends. Usually, ideally, it would be outside. And maybe just as simple as going for a walk. Something where I can literally just put one foot in front of the other and pound the pavement. But if that's not reality, which it wouldn't be today, because of ice and snow, I would just do some kind of gentle stretching or something like that.
Yeah. This episode is coming out in the spring, so ice and snow will hopefully be part of our long, long past memory. You're already focusing on your tubers and starting to get them in the ground, and I can't wait to see what those look like. Amy, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your very pragmatic advice about how we can be thinking about keeping our bodies healthy, and the not just the inside, but the outside that the world sees as long as we possibly can.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me. It's been great.
I got a lot of questions answered, and I still have so many more. I feel like I could have talked to Amy for another 2 hours and talked about a lot of other things that have either been on my mind or conversations I've had with girlfriends about what's on their minds and their bodies. I hope that this was enlightening for you. Maybe you learned a few things, maybe you learned a few terms, maybe you thought about a few steps in your routines or how you think about your skin or your hair or your nails, and it helps you take a different step. Or if you haven't had a conversation with a dermatologist in a while and you're due for screening, maybe this one is your call to action to go schedule that appointment with that very important partner in our health, your dermatologist. Thanks so much for being here.